Oh, good evening or good afternoon to all of you and all of you online as well. I'm delighted in looking through the tablet and seeing your faces and names. Thank you. And I hope that you are all availing yourself of one of the teachers we have here for the retreat here at IRC, and that is the land, the grounds, the nature that's here on this property itself. That maybe even just walking a little bit into the forest there along some of the trails, it's quite something. And even walking and hearing the freeway, there is a silence here, a quiet. That's good. If you listen for it with that inner ear, it's quite nice. The couple who lived in that house where we have now, across just out the window there, the treehouse, they lived there for 40 years or so. And they were living there before this building was built, which was about, I guess, suppose now it's about almost 35 years ago or so. And they must, and 40 years ago they were, I guess they lived there 40 years ago when we bought this property, which was 10 years ago or so. They were first here 50 years ago. So there was nothing here, and they used to come over and walk through the forest that was here regularly. And they said to each other, this would be a really good place for a meditation center. So when we came, they were still living there. They were so happy to have us there. They said that they were going to, there was a fence between their properties. They said they wanted to make a gate in the fence so they could just come over and meditate. So there's something about this property that maybe was a really good match for being a meditation center. So maybe to avail yourself of the redwood trees, the forest, the paths. There's something here that will support you. And am I speaking loud enough? And we see in the teachings of the Buddha that he used a lot of metaphors from nature. And he used metaphors from nature to, for describing meditation practice, both the practice and the results of the practice. And I don't think it was just cute little metaphors he's using. It was one of the ways that he gave instructions. In fact, sometimes you can get more instructions from the metaphor he uses than from his kind of prose descriptions of the practice or the instructions. And how it works is that if you can kind of inhabit the metaphor or take it in or imagine a situation that you've seen like this or been in this, and then the feelings, the impact it has on your body, on your mind, on your heart, and that kind of, that then he's using that to point us, that's the direction, that's what to kind of tune into or be aware of, something like that. And because it was an oral culture at the time of the Buddha, they didn't really have any writing to say, speak of. They, I think of it as the metaphors are the music of the Dharma that's being played. So the metaphor that's in the theme of this retreat is that of the dawn before the sun has arisen. And that as the dawn comes, you see the beginning of the light. If you look to the east, you start seeing maybe a little line of light starting to shine up the distance. And that's the precursor or the heralder of the sun that's going to rise. And when I think of that metaphor as kind of a practice instructions, I will think about it. So many of the early dawns that I've experienced in many different settings where it was quite peaceful. It was very quiet, very still. There was kind of a things were, life is simple. And I think I felt simple before the email started coming on, phone calls and whatever it is that we get busy, all the to-do lists aren't quite awake yet. If you're awake at dawn, the to-do lists are usually kind of just still, they're kind of late. And I hope yours are late in waking up. And so there's something very kind of peaceful about the dawn. And I remember being on some mountain lakes in the early morning, and there's no wind and maybe clear skies, and then looking out across the lake at the dawn, and it's completely still. So you can just, I felt like I could just let my eyes gaze across that stillness, that peacefulness of the lake for a long time. So the Buddha is evoking the dawn, the peace of the dawn, the quiet of the dawn, and saying that that's the precursor for the rising of the sun. And the sun is what gives a lot of light. It shines light on everything. Everything, you know, there's then no more darkness. Everything is lit up when the sun is out, kind of. And the sun is a metaphor for the Eightfold Path. And then it goes through each of the Eightfold Paths, and I'll say more about it later. So today's topic is, yesterday's, Shelley's was accomplishment in desire. And as she said, it's kind of a little bit surprising to have a Buddhist text that gives such a positive place for desire. Buddhism is strongly associated, sometimes in popular mind, Buddhism is like the anti-desire religion. And you're supposed to let go of all desires, of kind of some people's popular idea of Buddhism. And that's not the case, and the idea is definitely a wholesome and appropriate and a celebratory, wonderful way to have desires in the Dharma. And so the same surprise comes when we have this now accomplishment in self, when the popular view is the Buddhists don't believe in any self, and some Buddhists believe there's no self, and it's a little bit of a headache for the rest of us if they believe that too strongly as a view, as a philosophy. And so it's a little surprise, like here at the center stage, accomplishment in view, in self, like that's a little bit of a surprise. But what the self refers to here is the inner life. And that inner life is the quality of that inner life has a lot to do with what we do, how we live our life. And the quality of our inner life is something only each of us can be responsible for ourselves. Shelley talked about how there's wholesome and unwholesome desire, but sometimes you can only find out what's really going on with desire, but really understanding how the unwholesome, unskillful desire is disappointing or is stressful or causes suffering or is unsatisfying, doesn't provide satisfaction. And then discovering there's another kind of desire which does. And Shelley talked about how the unwholesome desire, more often, it has to do with a desire for an object, and that the more wholesome desire is a desire to how we act, in a certain way of how we behave. And in Buddhism, that means how we behave physically with our body acting in the world, how we behave in our speech, and how we behave in our mind, in our hearts, what goes on there. And we can have desires about how we behave more than about what we can get, some object or something. And that even applies to ourselves when we objectify parts of ourselves or objectify things like, I really want to get concentrated, get a deep state of concentration. And we treat it as an object that's out there or in there somewhere that we have to kind of get. And there's this kind of object-subject, subject-object kind of relationship with that we get kind of caught up in. If instead we take a look at, yes, getting concentrated is a nice thing, it's less important to get concentrated as it is how we get concentrated, how we act, how we behave, how we use the mind in order to get concentrated. And we want to be able to use our attention, use our focus, use our mind in such a way that we're creating music for ourselves, such a way that's beautiful, that it's nice, it's wonderful. And to become, use mindfulness to begin looking at the quality of how we behave, and the quality of the desires we act on. And so rather than what we're trying to accomplish, how we're accomplishing it is important, very important for doing this practice. And I think of us as, if meditation is music, then we ourselves are both the musician and the instrument that we're playing. And so that's kind of cool. And then attention, how we use our attention is how we play the instrument. And the music that we want to create, the Dharma music that we want to create out of Dharma practice, is the Eightfold Path. And so that's what the metaphor says, is that the dawn is a precursor for the arising of the Eightfold Path. And usually they're called right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And I think, didn't Shelley do wise yesterday?
I said wise.
Wise, yeah. So some people will call it, say, wise. The word in Pali is samma. Samma, and samma comes etymologically, which, some people think is fun to look at etymology. It comes from the Sanskrit word connected to one, to a oneness. And I like to call it complete. It's a complete view or a whole view. It's a complete way of intention or resolve. It's a complete way of speaking. And the idea of becoming whole through this practice is complete. I think it's a beautiful metaphor for this practice, because for many of us, we live fragmented lives. We cut off parts of ourselves. We don't develop parts of ourselves. We're at war with ourselves. We somehow limit ourselves. And that's one of the dangers of this notion of self, is that too many people have some idea of who they are as a self, and it limits who they are. And they become incomplete in their insistence, this is who I am. Probably the fairly obvious way of forming an identity which is incomplete is any kind of identity where you tell yourself that you're somehow unworthy or somehow wrong or somehow guilty or somehow, a bad person. That's always going to be limited. It always is going to not, that's not the whole. That's not complete. Any kind of way that says that you're a problem. As soon as you say that, somehow, some version, I'm a problem for myself, for the world, or for life, then we're not complete. We're kind of limiting ourselves to something very narrow. And one of the reasons that's incomplete is it's focusing on some idea of who we are instead of focusing on how we act, what we're doing. And it's what we do that the Buddha emphasizes so important, not who you are. You can be who you are, but what I think what's beautiful about Dharma practice is it's a practice of becoming whole in ourselves, feel yourself holistically, or all of who we are is included. But when we limit ourselves and have a narrow view of who we are, then there's going to be problems, lots of problems. And it tends to be an attachment. It tends to be we're seeing ourselves through an idea rather than seeing ourselves, as someone who's playing music. And it's the music playing, it's the how we are that's important. And it's fine to think that you're a problematic person, provided you play music with that. How do you make the best music possible with that? And this, if attention is the music, is how we play the instrument, attention, just like Shelley said about desire, can come along with a lot of baggage that's painful, a lot of attachments, a lot of judgments, a lot of expectations, a lot of demands. But attention can also come along free of all those things. Attention can come along with generosity, with love and care and a kind of gentleness, peaceful, a calm. There can be calm attention. There can be peaceful attention. And I certainly have practiced meditation in ways that my attention was not beautiful. It was ugly, I would say. I was just straining and pushing and trying to get concentrated, trying to get something to happen, trying to make something go away. And I've done the whack-a-mole approach to meditation. Something comes up and I just try to hit it over the head to get it, make it go away, and then it just pops up someplace else, and that's a game I usually lose. And so there's all these kind of things which are not pretty, how we practice. We hate what's happening. We hate ourselves for what's happening. And so the question is not that that's wrong, but how do I now open up to see the whole picture rather than that limited picture? How do I open up the attention so the way that I'm attending to myself hating my knee pain, that's included in a beautiful way? Is that possible? So it's only possible if we're not blinded by our attachment to outcome, attachment to avoiding something, attachment that it's supposed to be, it's a second day, I should be in some kind of bliss realm by now, and so then we're so feel betrayed by everything. We feel betrayed by IRC, we feel betrayed by the teachers, feel betrayed by the Buddha, we feel betrayed by a friend who told us to go here. There's a problem out there. When you expect the world to be the custodian of your inner well-being, you're in trouble. If you make the world responsible for your inner life, you're in big trouble. The other people, other things, other activities, they're going to do it. The most reliable place to care for your inner life, the most reliable person who can do it is yourself. We have to, each of us, care for our inner life. Have a desire to make that kind of flower and make music and be nice. And so if I hate my knee and then hate my hate, that's not music. Or if it is, it's discordant. But if you hate your knee and then you say, let's open up here. Let's kind of be aware of this too. Let's kind of make more space. That's a nicer thing to do. And as you start getting the whole picture, the whole, then, and not blinded by a narrow picture to a particular way of being or idea or attachment, things are changing dramatically. And this movement towards whole, being holistic, complete, everything becoming complete in ourselves, the complete Noble Eightfold Path. not the more than the right one. And so in this regard, one of the important aspects of mindfulness practice is how we use our attention. And one way we can use it is we are offering to make breathing room for whatever it is we're paying attention to. We're making space for it to be there. So rather than getting narrowly focused on the thing itself, zeroing in, boring down, or trying to get kind of get really laser focused attention or laser focused hate or laser focused desire for something else, is whatever is happening here, what happens if I allow it to be there and open up and make space for it? Maybe we don't have to fix so much. Maybe we don't have to actively try to change anything. What we do with attention, awareness, is this too is included, okay, like this. So if there's anger, this too gets to be included. And one of the remarkable things about meditation, I believe, is that it's one of the safest and best places in probably, if not the world, if not the universe, at least the world, for you to be angry. Because you're sitting, you're not going to move. You're kind of not supposed to move when you're meditating, so you're probably not going to punch anyone out. You know, it's okay, and so you can let the anger just be there, and then see, you know, what would be the beautiful way of holding that anger, making space for it, allowing it to be there, not because we're condoning it and just going to allow it to run over you. But once you start making space and open up and have attention that's wider than the anger, you're not defined by the anger anymore. When we're narrowly caught up in it, we're defined by it. So the idea is to open up. And part of the definition of meditation, one definition is that we're just making more space so we have greater capacity, greater and greater capacity to feel, sense, be with whatever experience we have in our life. And that gives a tremendous equanimity, and it gives us, and it protects us from being so consumed or so caught reactively to what's happening that we don't have access to wisdom. We don't have access to clear understanding and don't have the ability to call upon some of the wisest resources we have inside because we're so reactive. There's no space. We're claustrophobic. So in this idea of metaphors giving us idea of the practice. So imagine that, you're going camping and you're so lucky because in this camping trip, you've been given a recliner to take with you. The problem is that the tent that you're going to have, it just fits the recliner. And you can sit on it in the recliner just fine. It's just high enough for that. But there's really almost no space around it that the tent is close in. And so everything you brought with you is has to kind of like be around that reclining chair. And it's kind of claustrophobic. You can't really lift your arm up and you can't stand. And it's this little tent and your wonderful recliner. You're so lucky you have this recliner. So comfortable. But wow, you know. And then if you have to, but then it's raining. You know, you went on a day, there's a storm. And so you're just left in the tent all day. And then there's, not only that, but your friend's with you. And so somehow you have to figure out, you know, how to sit there with your friend and friend kind of like, I don't know, is under your feet or, you know, you're both sitting on the side, on the arms, and that kind of works because you can't sit. And so it's like, you know, and you're good friends until then, but, and then if you try to kind of move around, there's all this gear and stuff you have to climb over and it's like claustrophobic and nothing works. And you think you stepped on your friend's glass water bottle and it's when you heard all the glass break and the storm goes on and on. I mean, it's like, so that's, it's claustrophobic. A lot of people live their life that way. But then, someone comes along, maybe a wizard and abracadabra, and they make a tent that's 10 by 10. And suddenly there's space for you and your friend and the gear, and it's like, ah, oh, we can breathe. Now we can lay down. Now this is good. But the storm goes on for a long time. And then someone comes along and makes one that's 20 feet square, 40 feet square. And each time it gets bigger, you're not only happy to have your friend there, but you could imagine inviting other friends. It's, you know, it's like there's so much space and that you can the place can handle and hold a lot. And it seems like all that gear that you had that seemed like so difficult when there was such a small tent, now it seems like there's almost nothing around. It's just like mostly bare space and empty. You can even imagine dancing in that space. Imagine raining to the dancing to the rain. And so the amount of space that exists in these tents has a big impact on our mood, how we feel, and how we react to things. But the greater the space, the less reactivity there is, the less everything is oppressive. So when our minds are claustrophobic, when our hearts are caught up and small, and there's very little room for things, it can be quite oppressive and difficult. And one more little thing, one more little irritant, or one more person who asks you for something, it's just kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's just like, I don't have room for that. It's just I'm so fragile. But if the heart and the mind gets bigger, big mind, we would have talked about an expanded mind, that has lots of room, lots of space, so that if someone comes along and says that your shoes are ugly, if you were in that claustrophobic tent, like that, your friend said your shoes are ugly, like you can't take anything anymore. But in a 40-foot square tent, and your friend says, you know, your shoes are ugly, you know, you don't even know if you're going to have shoes at the end of the storm because you left them outside the tent. So whether my metaphors are the best choice here or too silly, the point being that for this idea, it is possible to become calm and centered, to use the awareness, attention in such a way that's kind of like you're making space, making room for whatever you're paying attention to, rather than using attention as a way of getting tighter around things. So if we're reactive, judgmental, if we have a lot of desires and wants that we're attached to, that comes along with how we pay attention, and it affects the attention. Attention is not just innocent, because it has a lot to defined a lot by what comes along and with it. And so that attention can be fragile, that attention can be forceful, it can be contracted, it can be narrow, it can be problematic. It's certainly not making beautiful music. But part of what we're doing here in practice is training ourselves to make room, training ourselves to have an awareness that is not reactive. Part of us might be reactive, but we try not to have the awareness be reactive. How we know something. Oh, I have a lot of desires. It's a desire. As opposed to, oh, shoot. Boy, I'm a failure. I'm a Buddhist failure for having a desire. That's like with a lot of difficult baggage. But just, oh, there's a desire here. What's this like? I have all the time in the world. It's a really good attitude to have when you meditate. I have all the time in the world to become friends with desire, to make room for desire, and to get to know it. As I said, it doesn't mean that you're committing yourself to just have more and more desire. In some ways, it's the opposite. It makes room for the desire to relax. It makes room for us to see the bigger picture of what's happening. It makes room for us to be reminded of how we are when we're whole, rather than how we are when we're limited, when we're caught up in a desire, what we want. And the feeling of becoming whole, I think is one of the great gifts of a good life. We don't feel broken, we don't feel partial, we feel complete, we feel whole, just the way we are, and we don't, any kind of thought, idea we get from ourselves or what other people say that doesn't acknowledge our wholeness as a human being, it doesn't have any, doesn't land anywhere in the great space of the mind, great space of the heart. So when the Buddha talked about accomplishment in self, he was not talking about self as an idea. In fact, he said any idea you don't have to agree with this, but he said any idea that you have about what the self is will cause stress. But he wasn't saying there's no self. He wasn't to destroy the self. In this kind of use of the word self, it's not an idea, but rather it's an activity of becoming whole, activity of developing these beautiful qualities we have inside. And some of the beautiful qualities that are part of this come from this being accomplished in self is the arising of the Eightfold Path. So whatever this accomplishment in self is, it's one that has room, makes space for something to appear. And so in the full sun, there's lots of light, there's lots of space. I've been in the middle of the night where someplace where you couldn't see very far. And then as dawn happens, you can see a little bit further, a little bit further. So it's full sun, you can look, you know, a big, big vista. And so this kind of, in darkness, you don't see very far. In light, you can start seeing much more. And so that's what the practice is, shining light on everything so we can see and see and see. And in that, and then what the Buddha talked about was the arising of the Eightfold Path. Many people associate the Eightfold Path with something we're supposed to do, eight practices we're supposed to do. The most common way the Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path was not as a practice we do, but rather as states that arise when there is no attachment, no clinging, no hatred, no resistance, no claustrophobic heart and mind. There's something that when we start creating this space, vast, soft, friendly, empty space in the heart and the mind, there are, it's kind of like you've cleared the weeds away from a flower bed, and now a seed of something you want to grow there can grow up from that flower bed. There's room for it to grow. So the growing of the Eightfold Path, Buddha uses the word arising of the Eightfold Path, and he also uses the word actually literally to, it grows, kind of like a plant. And part of the reason this is the case is that the Eightfold Path, this complete view, complete things, has a lot to do with absence. We've kind of made room by not being so busy doing things. So, for example, the second one, right intention, is we stop being busy being cruel. That really helps. Or having a lot of ill will. If you have ill will and cruelty and want to harm people, there's not much room for something beautiful to flower and grow there. It's a lot of weeds are overgrown. The definition of right view, right intention, or complete intention, is absence of cruelty, absence of ill will. Right speech, it's the absence of lying, absence of divisive speech, absence of harsh speech. Again, it's the absence of something. And hearing is just an absence, seems like that's not much. But boy, if you've been around the world and seen the consequences of cruelty and hatred and seen the consequences of people who lie and use divisive speech, it's quite something not to do those things. It's pretty special. And then the right action is also what we don't do. We don't kill, we don't steal, and we don't engage in sexual misconduct. That's also pretty special. It creates a kind of cleanliness. There's a feeling of inner cleanliness that comes from all this. And then there's right view, a right intention, which has a lot to do about what we don't do. We don't do the unskillful things. It does talk about doing the skillful things. And right mindfulness. And I think, as I said the other day, right mindfulness has a lot to do about not being preoccupied. And sometimes some of us try a little bit too hard to do the mindfulness. The mindfulness is a little bit more something, the awareness practice is a little bit more something we be than something we do. And so the doing we do is allowing, just allow ourselves. And if we try to do it too much, we narrow the space in the tent. We narrow the space in the mind. And right concentration, there's some teachers who will, the first instructions I got on concentration practice and I went to Thailand, where I said concentration is mostly about letting go. Just let go, let go, let go. And that's also about what you don't do. And but in that, there's beauty that comes. There's something beautiful that happens. To let go and get concentrated creates some of the most beautiful states that we have. And there also, there's the metaphor that's used there is of an underwater spring of water, that's spring that's coming up from the bottom of the lake, bringing this refreshing water through the lake, this upwelling from the inside out. And if you want this upwelling from the inside of our being flowing out, we have to make room inside. We have to be attuned and attentive to what's happening here inside and make room. To be accomplished in self is to be accomplished in creating all this whole sense of a whole integrity, completion, that has a lot of space and room for something innate and natural to grow and develop and flow through us. If we're too busy doing, it can't grow. But if we do nothing, and then the weeds grow. So we have to do something. And luckily, that something is almost like next to doing nothing. It's mostly letting go, allowing, opening up. Okay, this too. So that one of the great mantras for this practice of mindfulness is the mantra, this too. This too I have to pay attention to? This too I have to include? You gotta be kidding. This too? Yes, this too you have to make room for. And then trust for the time being that's okay to make room for murderous rage. Just okay, this too. And then after a while you'll see that, oh, this is actually, to make this kind of room in this kind of setting like we're practicing here, where you're not going to go out and act on anything. This allows for healing, it allows for revealing, it allows for things to be processed and change and work itself out. And then some of these beautiful qualities, like of the Eightfold Path, can begin bubbling up. And the way of this Sun series, talks about the Eightfold Path. There's actually two of these Sun series of suttas, of discourses. The first one that we're referring to here doesn't just say it's the Eightfold Path that arises, but it says it's the Eightfold Path that arises together with a connection or a association with a feeling of independence, a feeling of dispassion or lack of attachment, And come it's kind of freedom. So with independence and freedom from attachment, and a kind of beautiful ending of attachment. Like, so there's an association with some real goodness of kind of this sense of inner freedom, inner independence, inner that, oh, something has stopped. The refrigerator humming has stopped. This is good. So that's the first series. The second series has almost exactly the same text, except there it says the Eightfold Path that leads to the ending of greed, that leads to the ending of hatred, and leads to the ending of delusion. So what we see here is that it's not a passive thing. We don't end up just passively kind of doing nothing and twiddling your thumbs when we create this fullness, this wholeness of self that includes everything in lots of space. It's as Shelley said, she loves the term onward leading. It's an onward leading something that allows something to grow within us. Something like a plant in the tree in the forest that can grow and blossom. And part of that blossoming is the end of every possible form of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's pretty cool, pretty phenomenal. And part of what I find phenomenal is that this is not an engineering job. This is not a sophisticated job at, understanding, getting a PhD in Buddhism doesn't help, I can tell you. It's about getting out of the way, learning how to get out of the way of yourself. And if you get out of the way of yourself completely enough, then you become accomplished in self. We're playing the instrument of who we are. The self is the instrument we play until the instrument dissolves. So, tomorrow morning there'll be instructions on mindfulness of emotion. And this idea of that we're making room is really pertinent, that we're also making room for our emotions. And I'll say more about it, but making space for them so that no matter what the emotion you have, it doesn't have to be seen as a problem. If anything, it's seen as just one more thing, this too, one more thing with which we can discover how we're attending, the kind of attention we bring, because it's how we act that the real inner benefits of Dharma practice come. It's not what's happening, it's how we act in relationship to it. So if there's anger, how we act in relationship to it is to make space for it and feel it and know it, without feeling any hostility to it or any shame to it or just anything else. Just, oh, it's just, this is how it is. If you're a dishwasher or you're a veggie chopper or a floor mopper, getting the job done is not as important at IRC than how you do it. Don't do it too slow. That doesn't work. But can you do it and how you do it so that you're actually mindful of the quality of how you move your arms and how you hold something and how you stand and how you move. If you focus on getting the job done as quickly as you can, you're losing an opportunity to do it in a way that's playing music, doing art, making something beautiful. And ultimately, what we're making beautiful is this inner life, the quality of our inner life. The only custodian for your inner life is yourself. And that's, I think, a powerful statement. It's, there's something that's only up to you. And I can assure every single one of you that there is plenty of beauty in there waiting for you. You can grow into a wholeness, a completion, a completedness, a fullness. So that the Eightfold Path becomes complete view, complete intention, complete speech, complete action, complete livelihood, complete effort, complete mindfulness, and complete concentration. And you become the complete you. That would be a gift to the world. So thank you very much.